news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be broadcasting to you across space and time from my headquarters here deep beneath Appalachia. As we do every week, listen on demand via podcasting apps in every pocket. And of course, our station affiliates over there at the UnX Radio Network. Yeah, this is a rare instance where I think it's warmer here in Western North Carolina, where I'm based, than it is out further west. More on that in a moment. And also a couple of articles that my pal Tim McMillan and I dropped over there this weekend at thedebrief.org. Yeah, they seem to have resonated with some folks out there in the UAP community, prompting a few rather interesting phone calls. Maybe I'll tell you about that a little later. But of course, Tim McMillan is going to be jumping on the mic with us to discuss why the Pentagon won't release footage it has of unidentified objects. But yes, I'm talking about the ones suspected of being commercial balloons that were shot down over the U.S. in recent days. I'll have a whole lot more regarding the UAP issue to discuss with Mr. McMillan when he joins us. That and, of course, news and also some analysis of some very interesting discussion. Some talking points provided by the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, last month at an event where she spoke about classification and excessive use of secrecy by the United States federal government. That and much more awaits, as always, but of course, first, I hope you guys are all having a great start to your week. Mine has been busy as usual, but I'm very glad, as always, to be here and providing news and views to every one of you out there. Of course, if you guys have news tips, sightings, reports, if you saw something unusual in the sky, if you've got a technology forecast, anything you'd like to pass along, you can email me directly at info@MicahHanks.com, and you can also tweet at me at MicahHanks on Twitter. Lots of ways to reach me. Most of that information can also be found over there at MicahHanks.com, my main hub on the interwebs. So with that, we'll get right into things. As I was mentioning, out west, things have taken a turn for the cold. In fact, what many are calling an epic winter storm has turned Southern California snow white. Yeah, and the current forecast calls for more rain and snow soon to come. So you guys better batten down the hatches out there on the West Coast. I find this quite remarkable. My pal Jimmy Church was telling me the other day that he was out there shoveling snow where he lives in Southern California. Very unusual to see this. MSNBC also reporting on this. Residents across the Southland woke up to an icy wonderland Sunday morning, the result of a frigid winter storm that broke rainfall records and scattered fresh powder at elevations as low as 1,000 feet across the normally warm, sun-drenched region. Now, of course, I've been to Big Bear Lake, California, in January, and you can expect there's going to be a lot of snow up there at that altitude that time of the year. I was also actually back out there again this summer, and the weather was much nicer, going up there into the hills and looking around at the old gold mines, hiking in the beautiful forests, seeing all the wildlife. But yeah, when you're there in January, well, most people go there to ski, because of course you're going to have a whole lot of snow there at that altitude. But again, 1,000 feet, you're probably not going to be seeing 93 inches of snow at that altitude normally, not even this time of the year. But that's exactly what people said that they had in recent days. Again, MSN reporting that mountain communities in the region had been slammed by intense snowfall, with Mountain High Ski Resort, for instance, clocking that 93 inches I mentioned. The unusually strong winter storm closed the Grapevine, they note, a vital trucking artery that goes across the entire state of California, and it shut it down for several days. They say it knocked out power to thousands of utility customers, prompted rescues, and affected air travel, too. Lighter showers are expected through Wednesday, but nothing like those that have passed as of yet. For many Angelenos, they say these intense storms served as a reminder not to underestimate Southern California's capacity for truly wild weather. Boy, isn't that the truth. This is probably some of the wildest weather you guys have seen And of course, to all my friends out there in the Los Angeles area, if you guys have a weather report or any other information about the scene out there as it currently stands, and you'd like to pass that along, I'd like to hear from you. Of course, I've already put out the information about how to do that. Tweet at me right now, at Micah Hanks. I usually get those tweets pretty quick. Meanwhile, maybe it was weather, maybe it was something else that grounded a SpaceX rocket in recent days, but folks down there at Cape Canaveral said that it was a last-minute issue that forced SpaceX to have to call off Monday's attempt to launch four astronauts up to the International Space Station for the friendly folks over there at the American Space Agency, NASA. They're saying it was actually technical trouble, and that the countdown was halted with just 2 minutes remaining until liftoff from Kennedy Space Center. AP reporting here that with just a split second to blast off, there was no time to deal with the problem, which involved the engine ignition system. SpaceX delayed the launch until at least Thursday of this week. We will see if they get off the ground. Gosh, you know what? In fact, Brett Tingley is down there, I believe. He was covering this for space.com and sending me videos, so that's really going to be lame if they've had to push this launch back. But again, that happens pretty frequently. AP also adding that strapped into the capsule atop the Falcon rocket were two NASA astronauts, one Russian cosmonaut, and one astronaut from the United Arab Emirates as well. They had to wait until all the fuel was drained from the rocket before they could actually get out. So they're up there, they're ready to blast off. 2 minutes until launch, they are told, well, it's not going to happen today, we've got this ignition problem. But they can't just disembark. No, they got to sit up there and wait until all the fuel is drained out of that rocket. That takes a whole hour to do. We'll be sitting here waiting, Commander Stephen Bowen assured everyone. We're all feeling good. Yeah, I hope they went to the bathroom first, huh? Of course, I mean, they were all planning on flying to the International Space Station, so something tells me that having to sit there and wait another hour probably was not that big a deal, right? So maybe it wasn't the weather in the case of the SpaceX launch being set back. But when it comes to weather and the worries that it causes many people, here's a strange one. What if I told you that there were climate solutions that some were concerned could actually lead to war? How would that work? The Washington Post recently featured a story along these lines by Michael Birnbaum, and he had said that members of the U.S. intelligence community and other national security officials had been worried enough last year about how a war could be triggered by climate engineering, that in a role-playing exercise, it's been reported, they practiced managing tensions that would be unleashed, and this according to officials who are familiar with an exercise, and they said it was a sign that they see it as a credible threat in need of a strategy. What exactly are they talking about? Well, as Michael explains, known as solar geoengineering, it is possible in theory, and so as global decision-makers are likely to come under heavy pressure to deploy this technology in the years ahead, some scientists and policymakers have become concerned about what the geopolitical effects of that could be. As Michael explained in his article, because the technique would weaken the sun's power across the globe, not just above whichever country decided to deploy it, security officials said they were concerned about the potential to spark conflict, since a single capital could make decisions that shape the entire world's fate. Something tells me they may not just be talking about the United States or its allies doing this, right? This is the kind of thing where if any nation around the world that had the capability of doing so carried out geoengineering that affected the climate elsewhere, and maybe adversely so, yeah, this could lead to real problems. What are your thoughts about that? You know, call me old school, but I guess I'm kind of still in that camp where I worry about things like this. And by that I mean, it sounds an awful lot to me like playing God. There was a report that was issued a few years ago, by the way, where unforeseen circumstances that might arise from things like geoengineering to try and offset the effects of climate change could actually lead to even worse problems. This intelligence assessment, I'll have to dig up the report, but it looked at everything from the unforeseen consequences of artificial intelligence to geoengineering and other things too. And really, bottom line, to summarize, is that there are a lot of things that should be considered before action is taken. A whole lot. You know, one more thing I wanted to mention in our news segment. As of today, February 27th, 2023, today marks the 50th anniversary of an incident where members of the American Indian Movement took over the town of Wounded Knee. which of course began a 71-day occupation on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. According to the AP, the standoff, which grew out of turmoil within the Ogallala Sioux tribe, as well as a protest of the federal government's treatment of Native Americans, became violent at times, and two Native American men ended up being killed. The siege sowed divisions on the reservation and also left a lasting impact on members of the Ogallala Sioux tribe and the future of Native American activism. That happened 50 years ago today. The AP reached out ahead of the 50th anniversary of the occupation to many of the people who were actually there at Wounded Knee or involved, and they were sharing their stories. Dwayne Camp had been one of those individuals, a member of the Ponca tribe of Oklahoma. He had been originally in California when his younger brother Carter called and said he and other leaders of the American Indian Movement had taken a group of activists into Wounded Knee. As Mr. Kemp now recalls of what happened 5 decades ago, he was telling me they were in a hell of a fight. Kemp also said he remembered hearing the gunfire over the telephone. He said that was all I needed. I went up there and I stayed for the duration of the standoff. Now, their brother Craig, who had been a Vietnam veteran, also joined them. Kemp said that the rifles and shotguns the occupiers took from the trading post in town were no match for the weapons and armored vehicles the feds had brought in. We were going to make it very expensive should they go ahead and roll in, Kemp told the AP. It didn't come to that, thank goodness. But he remembers the occupation, he said with pride, as a very vital time that changed his life. I got to tell you, it changed a lot of people's lives, changed history. In fact, and that's why, of course, we mention it right here and now in this news segment. I'm going to have a couple of those stories linked in the show notes about this, as well as always, all the stories that we cover every week here on this program. But here in a moment, I want to tell you about this article I did over the weekend over there at thedebrief.org talking about excessive secrecy in government. And we're also going to, as a prelude to the discussion with Tim McMillan and his own recent encounter with that kind of secrecy being shown by the Pentagon in this instance, we're also going to be reviewing some of the recent statements by our Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, about classification and excessive secrecy. More on that in just a moment. But first, of course, as I often do, I want to tell you guys about our next partner, somebody who has provided a product that I use every single day. You've heard me talk about it, and you know I really do enjoy it. It's called AG1 by Athletic Greens. I do literally take it every single day. I gave it a try because I am, well, I guess what you'd call a health nut, right? I'm one of those people who exercises every day. I try to eat right. I mean, I'll cheat a little bit every now and then, have a cheeseburger on the weekends. I think everybody does. But when it comes to my weekday routine, my ritual every morning, you might say, I tear open that package of AG1, I pour it into a glass of water, and I stir it, and I drink it, and I go, because it always gives me that extra energy lift, helps me when I'm working out. I like to do my workouts early in the day. And it's also going to help you as you try it at home. I know a lot of you guys already have. Many of you tell me about this. For those of you who haven't yet, but you intend to, you've heard me talking about it and you're saying, okay, you know, I'm starting to get really interested in why you talk about this all the time. Let me tell you what it will do for you. You will find that you will have better sleep at night. You're going to find that AG1 by Athletic Greens also promotes better gut health. It's going to help you sustain your energy levels throughout the day. And of course, when you use it, you're also going to have the satisfaction of knowing that you are getting all kinds of vitamins, adaptogens, minerals, all of these completely free of any kind of processed ingredients or sugar, although it does actually taste great. But you're getting all of these vital nutrients that your body needs in a single dose. You won't have to take a ton of pills and vitamins and other kinds of supplements. You get all of these daily essentials in just one scoop that you add to a glass of water. Again, why would you take a bunch of different things when you can have the benefit of taking it all in at once, thanks to the folks at AG1 by Athletic Greens? So look, if you are looking for an easier way to take supplements, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Here's all you got to do. Head over to athleticgreens.com/Micah. That's athleticgreens.com/MICAH. athleticgreens.com/Micah. Check it out. I know you're going to love it just like I do. All right. And when we come back here in a moment, we're going to get into some of this audio from DNI Avril Haines, speaking about classification and excessive secrecy. In fact, I'm going to give you a few of my thoughts on excessive secrecy too. Before we jump into that audio, all that and more awaits you when we return here in just a moment on the Micah Hanks Program. When secrecy becomes excessive, at what point is there too much that's being withheld from the public? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. A little later, we're going to be joined by my colleague and co-founder there at thedebrief.org, Tim McMillan. But first, I want to get into some of this discussion about remarks that were delivered last month by the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines. And she was speaking at this event about classification. I mean, I get it. I'm a journalist, and I respect the necessity for some secrets that are kept in the furtherance of national security. I understand that very clearly. But there are times where secrecy can become excessive. That was the main thrust of the article that I did over there at the Debrief this weekend. That one was published on Sunday morning, and it was a follow-up to a piece published on Friday by Tim McMillan, which you'll be discussing. But the main focus that I was trying to convey in this article had been that at some point, we have to be concerned that the government is not providing enough information, and at times, some of the information that it could and perhaps should be providing, it still deems to be classified. Case in point, in recent days, as we have seen, there has been a woeful lack of information provided to the public about these objects, which, of course, in recent days, we've spoken about at length on this program. And if you've been following our work there at thedebrief.org, you also have read all about. In fact, it's hard to miss, considering that this has been topic A for several weeks now. And yet, we still don't know exactly what the objects are because the government won't release any further details other than, well, we suspect that they were probably commercial balloons. Again, the fundamental question that I've had and so many others have asked is, at what point did it become U.S. strategic policy not to identify objects, but to shoot them down, not to be able to recover the remains, and to leave the public wondering? I mean, this is exactly what gives rise to conspiracy theories. And if we don't want speculation, if we don't want idle minds and imaginations running wild about alien life and extraterrestrial vehicles in our atmosphere, then you probably shouldn't say we just shot down three unidentified objects, we can't find the wreckage, we've called off the search, we still don't know what they are. All you are doing is giving the public license to speculate. And in fact, again, as many congressmen and senators have said in recent days, there really probably isn't information about all this that should not be given to the public. Therefore, there must be political reasons why it is being withheld. We'll get Tim McMillan's thoughts on that here shortly. First, though, I do want to get a few perspectives from the Director of National Intelligence. And in my article, I quoted very briefly from a portion of the audio you're about to hear where she was delivering these remarks at an event back in January addressing classification and excessive secrecy. We'll get right into that audio right now.
Many have noted that the amount of classified information, whether properly or not, has increased significantly over the last 50 years, and deficiency in the current system have led to overclassification as well as underclassification, but on balance, significantly more overclassification than underclassification. And this is an urgent challenge to solve because, first, overclassification undermines critical democratic objectives, such as increasing transparency to promote an informed citizenry and greater accountability. And second, overclassification undermines the basic trust that the public has in its government. And third, overclassification negatively impacts national security because it increases the challenges associated with sharing information that should not be classified, or at least not classified at the level the information is classified at. And I'll focus on the third point, even though I believe the first two are at least as important, if not more so. I'm just uniquely qualified as a consequence of my position, I think, to make the case for how overclassification can negatively impact national security, particularly given the current threat landscape. As the Ukraine war demonstrates the importance of sharing intelligence on key national security threats with allies, partners, and the public could not be more important. And thus having a system that can facilitate such sharing as much as possible through properly classifying such information initially and ultimately having the resources to review and downgrade or declassify what can be released is critical. This is particularly true today as essentially every significant national security and foreign policy challenge we face requires us to work with partners and allies. But even within our institutions, the challenge of overclassification and compartmentation, which is a derivative of the broader problem, creates challenges for our work. We've seen this in areas such as space, for example, where military leaders have publicly discussed the fact that compartmentation has made it especially challenging to work across agencies and departments to develop comprehensive strategies that take into account everyone's equities and interests, and consequently minimizing overclassification or compartmentation is crucial to maximizing our capacity to help policymakers and operators make better decisions. And of course, we are increasingly in need of sharing downgraded information with the private sector and other entities who are on the front lines of cyber attacks or other threats for which the intelligence community's warning may make the difference between success and failure, including of critical infrastructure. Yet in many respects, the challenge is only becoming more acute, exacerbated by the growing amount of classified material that has proliferated across a wide range of agencies, which in part is simply a reflection of the degree to which the impact and importance of national security issues that come from abroad are of importance to everyone in our country.
Now, briefly, I'd like to jump in and just add right there that as you're hearing her describe these issues, we have a whole lot of classified information, maybe too much of it. There are reasons, of course, why some information must be classified, but DNI Haynes is also making the argument there, a few seconds ago, how the release of information to those who need it, when information can be declassified, can be helpful in a lot of different areas. I think she gives examples like infrastructure, but of course, keeping in mind the focus of this program, I can't help but wonder about information about UAP. Right? Information that the public should have. Over the weekend for X subscribers, I was talking about Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana. And he had said at one point, the DNI just needs to stand up in front of the American people and tell them what's going on. Granted, he was also talking about all these incidents in recent days with suspected balloons that were shot down. But keep in mind all the other things that our intelligence agencies are collecting information about. Let's also not forget about that instance up there at the National Cathedral where David Ignatius of the Washington Post is asking DNI Haynes about the information that is collected on UAP. And DNI Haynes responds, talking about the different categories of UAP, which include foreign surveillance platforms, aerial clutter, all these things, right? And then she also says, but then there is that other category, the one that we leave open for the possibility that there may be things we can't necessarily identify in our skies with ease. And don't forget about her also saying, and we leave open for the possibility that some of those things may also come extraterrestrially. DNI Haynes does not seem to me like a sensational person or someone who uses very sensational language, quite the opposite, in fact, as I think the audio we're about to jump back into helps to clearly illustrate. And she wasn't saying we have evidence of ET, but she is saying there may be things in our skies that we can't easily identify. And kind of like General Van Herk had said in recent days, talking about all possibilities remaining open when he's asked about extraterrestrials by Helene Cooper, Pentagon correspondent to the New York Times. There may not be proof of that, but Avril Haynes, like General Van Herk, apparently based on the intelligence that he has, is open to all possibilities. One has to wonder what kind of intelligence they have received, what kind of information they've been made privy to that would cause them to make statements like that. I also don't think I'm being sensational, mind you, by raising that point. But now getting back into this audio with Avril Haynes.
And all of this is to say that not only is this an important issue for our democracy, it is also critical to our national security. This problem undermines our capacity to effectively support senior policy decision making, to rapidly share and disclose information to allies, partners, and the public, and erodes the basic trust that our citizens have in their government, which makes it harder for us to do our work. And having said all that, however, I want to acknowledge that the challenge is more complex than I think most people realize at the outset. There are some real pragmatic challenges that we face as we try to create a system that is more effective. First, I want to say what is likely obvious but worth perhaps reiterating, which is that we must keep certain information secret or we will not be able to do our job in the intelligence community. But it does have to meet a national security standard. And to be clear, just because information is inconvenient or embarrassing is not a basis for classification. But there are real national security reasons for keeping certain things secret that should not get in the way of promoting an educated public debate or doing our job. For example, while it may be important to disclose the fact of U.S. military action and the nature of the threat posed, which may have served as the basis for such action, if we don't protect certain information regarding, for example, the tactics we use, or details regarding the weapons employed, or sources who contributed to our work, we may lose the insights that help us avoid the next threat or put the lives of those who risk their security to support ours in grave danger, or give an adversary an advantage that puts our forces at risk. And keeping such information secret, even when properly classified, has nevertheless become much more challenging in light of technological advancements that have increased the risk of massive and damaging leaks. Technology has revolutionized the way information is created, stored, communicated, and accessed, making it far easier to leak classified information and to disseminate it, in some cases resulting in direct, immediate, and irreparable harm. Ironically, however, the effort taken to manage the increasing challenges associated with such leaks often make it, among other things, harder to devise a system that facilitates declassification when appropriate.
Think about what the DNI is saying right there. Issues that cause it to become difficult for declassification to occur, even when it is necessary, even when it is warranted. You know, I have my concerns, once again, comparing this all to the whistleblower amendment in the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that was passed this year. Here we have passed into law legislation that allows people who have knowledge about UAP-related programs to come forward and to speak about what they know. I have heard a few whispers in recent days about the kinds of things, the kinds of people who have come forward and who are providing testimony to AARO, the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. Of course, it's been made public that some of the personnel at strategic sites from back in the 1960s and 70s, people like Robert Salas, who were there on hand when these incidents involving missiles being shut down and taken offline at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Minot Air Force Base, and others. Yeah, it's already public knowledge some of those individuals have provided testimony to Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick and others with AARO. But one has to wonder, could there be a limitation, even though there is now law protecting those individuals, many of them, who would come forward and speak? What about those deep, dark, black programs, tucked away outside of government, in various contract agencies, various special access programs? This should apply to them in theory as well, but the question I'm asking here is, could there be levels of secrecy that would actually even prevent those individuals, perhaps those with the most pertinent information about the UAP topic, from coming forward? Think again about what DNI Haynes is saying right there about, even when information should be declassified, there being systems that make that difficult, issues that prevent it from happening. And right now, in this last audio soundbite we have time for before we bring Tim McMillan on, I want you to listen to how much data right now, how much classified information has accumulated in recent years based on reports that have been issued over the years.
Moreover, the sheer amount of information that all of us deal with every day, whether working in a classified or an unclassified environment, adds to the challenge. For example, in an already resource-constrained environment, we have a relatively small number of people, money, and subject matter expertise dedicated solely to declassification review. And that relatively small group faces the daunting task of processing requests from an utterly massive repository of records. As the PIDB, as I call it, essentially noted in one of its reports over 10 years ago at one intelligence agency alone, the growth of classified records was approximately 1 petabyte every 18 months, which they noted was about 49 million cubic feet of paper. Imagine what it is today, right? And how many people would it take to review that much information? And over the years, numerous investigations and reviews have been done in an attempt to identify ways to improve the current system. And they pointed to not only organizational and structural barriers, but also cultural issues that make this much more difficult. For example, these reports often point to the fact that there are virtually no incentives in our bureaucracy to declassify or to refrain from classifying a document, yet there are plenty of incentives to classify. And even the logistics of minimizing classification are surprisingly challenging for national security professionals. Reducing the amount of classified material takes additional time, which is at a premium in most of these jobs. Just to give an example, of which there are many, it takes extra time when writing an email or memos to mark classification of each paragraph or sentence in order to ensure that any unclassified information is marked as such.
Anyhow, I think you get the idea. That's about all we have time for right now. But just imagine how much classified information we are talking about right there. Petabytes, ladies and gents, that's a lot. Yeah, so even the Director of National Intelligence recognizes the issue here with overclassification and excessive secrecy. We'll see what my friend Tim McMillan has to say about that too when we return here in a moment on the Micah Hanks Program. So what does the Pentagon know about three unidentified objects that were shot down over North America? And why won't it release the videos? Again, the question I have asked in recent days on Twitter had been if they won't even show us the videos of suspected commercial balloons shot down with missiles, each costing around $400,000, mind you. Makes you wonder what they're doing with the really good UAP videos that we keep hearing about. Yeah, isn't that something? By the way, I do want to remind you guys, if you aren't already subscribers, we have recently redesigned the X subscribers site, and now you can find that online at an all-new URL. That's MicahHanks.com/X. And when you visit that URL, you can sign up and become an X subscriber, which gets you weekly additional podcasts, monthly specials, and of course your own unique RSS feed that will allow you access to all the shows produced by the Micah Hanks Program every week, and they'll all come to one place. You can subscribe using that special RSS feed at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or however you like to get your shows. But again, for just $7 a month, you get, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. And let me tell you, there's always a lot more every week for X subscribers. But now with that, I want to bring on Tim McMillan, because he's been waiting very patiently in the green room here in the bunker. I asked Tim to jump on with me because, as I was reviewing this audio you just heard from Avril Haines' speech back in January, and of course Tim and I were going back to back covering issues related to secrecy over the weekend, I thought it was only right to have him jump on the mic here with me. So Tim McMillan, without further ado, welcome to the Micah Hanks Program. How are you, sir?
What's going on there, Brother Micah Hanks? How are you?
Well, I'm living the dream one day at a time. And of course, don't forget, nightmares are dreams too.
Exactly. Yeah, man. Good to chat with you.
This has been a really strange time for us, and I don't want to sound like a broken record. At this point, it seems like most of the mainstream media has already kind of moved on from the war against the balloons of 2023, those events that shall go down in infamy. I've speculated that 30 years from now, somebody's going to be writing a book about how the U.S. government shot down UFOs in 2023, all in one weekend. And then the wreckage retrieval that was recovered was covered up. Which, on that point, by the way, It is interesting that during the press conference, you and I and Chrissy Newton were observing with Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh the other day, when one of the members of the press asked her about what the current position is on this. She says, as you know, we haven't recovered all the wreckage from those three objects. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I thought you hadn't recovered any of them. So some of the language is a little strange. That was probably a slip of the tongue. I don't know, Tim, am I reading too much into that, or is it warranted that I'm concerned about there being a level of excessive secrecy here?
Well, I don't think that you're, I don't think you're off base if you're considering excessive secrecy in totality. So with the whole Department of Defense and a lot that goes on there, I do think that Press Secretary Singh's kind of slipped up there. There's nothing that leads me to believe they've recovered anything, and they said they have. And so I think with that particular comment, I wouldn't read too much into that, just because she's not the one who usually handles the press now. Usually General Ryder does. And so there was more than a few instances. Nothing against her. I think she does a great job. But, sure. There's more than a few instances that you could see. You're filling in that spot. I think that when you're talking about excessive secrecy, particularly, these are really weird events.
They were.
They were so weird, they don't seem weird to us now. Like, it's just kind of like a meme. Like, we shot the balloons down. But if you really put them in perspective, this was a weird, really unprecedented time. I had to, go back to when, when has the U.S. engaged in aerial warfare over its own sovereign airspace? And that's not something easy. I mean, you have to go back to like World War II. And we're talking about Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And then, instances like that. And so this is a huge gap. This was the first time we've ever seen air-to-air missiles being launched over U.S. airspace, and to have it happen not once, not twice, but three, four times in like rapid succession of a week is just such a bizarre. It's so bizarre that it's one of the things you'll look back on and going, what happened? What happened there? What was going on?
Yeah. How do we get to this point? Well, okay. So maybe one could be reading too much into Sabrina Singh's statements, but now we also had John Kirby, who, when asked, you guys planning to release any of these videos? Kirby essentially says, and of course, this being in reference to videos presumably collected by camera systems on the fighter jets that intercepted these balloons or suspected balloons. But Kirby essentially said, I can't speak to that about whether those videos can be released. You'll have to go and you'll talk to the DOD about that. That's something that you did. Again, my takeaway from that was, okay, videos obviously do exist. Will we ever see them? That was the question on your mind when you went last week to the Pentagon. Tim, you want to tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah. No, and that is another very odd aspect of all of this. Just so we're all on the same page is, the video evidence. So we have kind of accepted that, they've called off the searches for these three objects. So you have the one suspected Chinese spy balloon. And that has been the payload that's been recovered, but these other three unknowns. And so, they're not going to recover them. Okay. So we don't have any physical evidence, I guess, to kind of get us an idea of what was this. So that really leads us to the potential of there being imagery evidence, taken from some of these targeting pods that are on those fighter jets. Yeah. You mentioned Kirby's comments, and I'll just briefly touch on that because it was odd. That was another press conference that you and I were tuning in together. And it was odd because Kirby, I don't remember his exact response, but it was essentially like, well, I don't even know if they got video. And then you're thinking, man, you would assume that the National Security Council, the president, the White House would have wanted to see this video. You would assume before you go, pull the trigger, blow them up. Let's see what we're looking at. So there was an odd response. But like he said, you'll have to talk to the DOD. And, you'd realize we'd received a lot of inquiries from readers of the debrief saying, hey, what's up with the videos? Seems like nobody else wants to ask. And so, I said, this is a very valid point. There's still some lingering questions here. And you mentioned that I think we say it in jest now, but I don't know that it'll be in jest 30 or 40 years from now, this idea that all these other facts get added to these events and suddenly, does it become Roswell Part 2, that kind of stuff. Well, the only way that you head that off is let's try to get some evidence out there and let's be transparent. You don't know what they are. Let's crowdsource it. Let's put it in the public forum. Let scientists and people observe it. And so, yeah. And so we reached out to the Pentagon and spoke with them. And I guess, probably a lot of people say, well, that's, predictable. They told me that, the first thing is, like John Kirby, which was interesting, is they would not even acknowledge that they had video. So that was the first thing. I said, but can you just confirm that you recovered some imagery whatsoever from any one of these three? Pick one. I don't care. And they told me that they couldn't. They said that, this came on the heels of them releasing the U2 spy plane selfie. And so, they said, that's the only image that we have released. And I said, okay, well, hypothetically, if there is imagery that exists, are there any plans in the works? If this is classified imagery, is there any plans in the works to declassify that? Or is there any planning going on right now to release this imagery to the public? And they went back to the, we got nothing on that. We're not going to discuss the imagery side of it whatsoever, even if it exists or not. And so it adds this other odd layer to an already really odd, bizarre series of events.
Yeah, this comes back to something I was discussing in the previous segment, where I was featuring these audio sound bites from DNI Avril Haines, where she in January had been speaking about classification and excessive secrecy, and how there are issues with classification and, more importantly, declassification of some information that should be released to the public due to conditions, systems, bureaucratic elements that make that declassification process difficult. I mean, the most bizarre thing about all this to me, and I did you a solid the other night, because when I was on Coast to Coast AM, I waited until I was on there. I had an audience of hundreds of thousands of people out there staying up all night. And then I tweeted your article, right? And I said this, that they won't release the videos of suspected balloons. It really makes you wonder how they're treating the UFO videos at this point, right?
Well, there could be some bleed over there. And I think that hasn't been discussed. And unfortunately, that is something else that I try to push the DOD on. I didn't include that in that particular article because it was kind of redundant at that point, because we're talking about hypotheticals. But there is this aspect of where the UAP classification could be bleeding into what's going on with these balloons, these balloon-like objects. That's the last description we have. But, here I am saying balloons. And in fact, the Pentagon themselves continues to say objects. But if you look at the classification guide, at least what we can look at, so the classification guide, for those who aren't aware, is really your textbook for anything that's classified. And so if you're dealing with UAP, you have this classification guide that tells you what is derivative classification, what's automatically classified, and why. And so this is kind of like your Bible of classification. And John Greenwald from the Black Vault, through FOIA, was able to get a highly redacted version of this classification guide. And so we can only kind of infer, because it is highly redacted, but there's certainly parts that indicate that UAP imagery is inherently classified, and they're classifying that under this threats to national security, so they represent vulnerabilities to national defense systems, which they could fit in there. If you've got some advanced craft that goes from zero to Mach 10, that's a huge vulnerability. But so they're inherently classified. Well, by the guide, so UAP imagery is inherently classified. Well, if these three objects, if they can't definitively say what they are, so if they're saying it's just balloon-like objects, but they're still technically unidentified, what I was trying to get asked is, are they being classified as UAP? Like, how are you classifying them? And I couldn't get that answered. But if they are being classified as UAP, even though it's been made clear to us with the individuals we've spoken to at the Pentagon who are familiar with these current ongoing efforts by AERO, that these three objects did not exhibit anything exotic and aren't being considered UAP, air quotes, and what we would also kind of associate with UFOs. So exotic, something different. And so they're different, but are they just being broadly lumped into UAP? And if that's the case, is that's what's causing this bottleneck of classification? And then to go back to what you originally said, it's fascinating that, people to kind of get an appreciation of this kind of empire that's going on inside this DOD is when you have the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, going, you know, there's overclassification. It's too, you know, there's stuff just like we discussed with that guy that's written derivative, inherent classified, born classified, that doesn't need to be, but that even the DNI, the highest ranking intelligence official in the U.S. government, she can't just wave a wand and go, it's declassified now. You know, only the president has that kind of carte blanche. And so it does add all these weird layers into it, which frustrates everything. It frustrates the public. And I think, you know, to the DNI's point, it frustrates the people on the inside. How do you clean that up is the big question.
Absolutely. You know, again, coming back to your article from Friday, one of the things that you pointed out, I mean, it just seems absurd to me to assume that there is not footage, at least of one of these objects. It seems almost impossible to me that that wouldn't be the case. And I'll tell you why. Because since when does the United States government shoot down objects that they can't identify? Even if they could not identify them, they would have had to have made attempts at doing so. And as you point out in your article, there were camera systems which we know were in use because we know which kind of aircraft were involved in these intercept attempts. And it's just baffling to me that at this point, the government will film objects, presumably, and then not release that footage and give no indication whatsoever, apart from, well, we suspect that they were commercial balloons, to the public in terms of what was believed to have been shot down and then never recovered. To call this a baffling series of events to me is an understatement. Could you talk a little bit, though, about those camera systems on board the fighter aircraft that were involved in these intercepts that you discussed on Friday?
Sure, yeah. No, and I think that's a great point because, for one, and I mentioned the article, is we know just about beyond a shadow of a doubt that at least the object that was shot down near the border of the U.S. and Canada, near Michigan, near Lake Michigan, there should be video there because amateur radio listeners, you know, tuning in to radio frequencies and scanning the airwaves, picking up radio traffic, were able to record some of the conversation, the cockpit conversation between the two F-16 pilots, and you hear one of them say, I'm looking at it through my pod, and it looks like. So he's talking about the targeting pod.
Right.
And so we know there should be video there. Now, the others, there should be. The F-22, so in the Chinese spy balloon shootdown, the Alaskan shootdown, and then the Northern Canada shootdown, those were all F-22 Raptor fighter jets that took those down. Now, in those particular cases, the aircraft that shot the object down, there may not be video. And the reason I say that is those aircraft are not outfitted with targeting pods. You know, the F-22 is no longer in production in the United States, even though it's a highly capable aircraft. They never outfitted them with these air-to-ground targeting pods. All these targeting pods are designed really to facilitate precision ground strikes, but they make for, tremendous air-to-air intelligence and recognition tools. So long-range air-to-air recognition. Most of us who've seen the infamous gimbal videos and the Nimitz Tic Tac video, that's where they're coming from. But the other aircraft, in Alaska, at least we don't know about Northern Canada because they haven't shared as much there. But in Alaska, they acknowledged that at least two times leading up to the shootdown, they sent F-35 fighters, and the F-35 is outfitted with a very sophisticated targeting pod system. It's built into the aircraft, actually, the ETOTS. Mm-hmm. So if you ever look at one, it's got this weird little mirror image on the bottom of it, a glass dome, it looks like. And it's got a good targeting system. So they should have had good visual recognition, long range, even better than what we see in, let's say, the gimbal video. And a lot of people are familiar with that UAP video. So better than that, frankly. And with the F-16s, they are outfitted with the sniper targeting pod. Probably the best, one of them. That and the Legion, which some of the F-15s have, are some of the best targeting pods. So they should have had a good video. All of these record, they can record in both TV and IR, infrared video. So you should absolutely have. And that's just talking about the aircraft that we know were involved. But at the same time, as we saw with the Chinese spy balloon, you had a U-2 plane flying over it. There's a lot of different assets. I mean, we can, I guess I shouldn't assume anything, but I pray that significant interrogation of these objects went on, both visually and through sensor systems. And so there are satellites that we have. There's satellite-based systems that could have given you imagery. There's a lot of ways that we could and on the balance of probabilities, most likely did record imagery of them. And so, you know, what they're willing to release, if, you know, which is nothing at this point, but certainly there are aspects, you know, if you looked at the F-35 targeting pods, you can clean those up and release them. You know, there's not going to be anything. Yeah, you know, you release a quick 30-second clip of that, there's not going to be anything that's really going to tell China or Russia about the capabilities. You know, it's not, there's not going to be harm there. So it's an odd, it's odd that they won't even at least say, yes, we have it.
Right. And I don't want to appeal to conspiracy, but I do have a sneaking suspicion that we all know, at least some of us, why these videos have not been released. I bet Tim McMillan has a good idea too. And when we come back here in a moment, I want to get his opinion on that. Why would we shoot down objects if they were unidentified and then not release videos if they were believed to be balloons? More on that in just a moment with Tim McMillan right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Catching up with Tim McMillan. He is, of course, an investigative reporter. He is the co-founder, along with yours truly, of thedebrief.org, a good pal of mine. And he's also our guest this week right here on the Micah Hanks Program. And it's about time for us to get back into this conversation, because I have a sneaking suspicion as to why the Pentagon has not and will not release videos of suspected balloons shot down over North America in recent days. And Tim, it really all essentially for me comes down to this. I feel like if those videos were to be released for one reason or another, and there are two likely possibilities, the Pentagon may feel like that will not make them look good. Your thoughts?
I agree with you, but perhaps not for the same reason that some may think that you know, that it's going to show a flying saucer, it's going to show the Tic Tac, or we're going to see you know, Skinny Bob, the gray alien, waving in the window. I believe I believe that there is very likely. I believe that some of the DOD's caginess has to do with the fact that there is very, very likely some underlying political motivation behind these shootdowns. Coming from the White House. So we're talking about political motivations in our elected officials' end of it, and how they're perceived. And I think that that factors into that. And I think that, you know, my opinion solely here, I think that you're onto something there, Micah, because, you know, the perception and how that would be used politically against the president, if these images show very clearly just a balloon, you know, if they show very clearly, you know, You can read on the side of it. It says atmospheric weather balloon, you know, launched from the Boy Scout troop number, whatever. You know, that's fairly embarrassing. I think most would agree that you sent fighter jets up to take this down. And so I think that there's definitely some political motivations could be there. I can't think of any other reason why not, even if they're somewhat ambiguous, you know, release them.
Yeah, there are two likely scenarios to me. One would be the concern over embarrassment, that people might be able to look at this, and individuals, you know, who follow open source intelligence and things like this, and who have been collecting information and following information about this themselves, they may see the footage, immediately identify that they are balloons, reveal something that would be embarrassing to the government. The other side is that the United States government may be well aware that these were balloons, and hence why they have strongly implied that that's what they were. But for reasons, again, political or otherwise, they know this, but they're withholding that information in the furtherance of ambiguity, which for some reason helps with the narrative that is being pushed. I think it's one of those two things primarily. Now, Tim, to kind of change gears here for just a moment, I'm looking at some of the issues with regard to secrecy. And, you know, I'm thinking about what DNI Haynes and others have said in recent days. And of course, you know, I did a follow-up piece over the weekend to your piece from Friday, which got a response from people in the community who kind of share my concern and yours about unnecessary secrecy related to the UAP issue. Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote that excellent book titled Secrecy a few years ago back, where he talked about how intelligence agencies that had been collecting information in advance of 9/11 were not sharing information with one another, and that that might have actually helped to allow the events that occurred that day, September 11th, 2001, to unfold. Had the intelligence agencies shared with one another some of what they knew, his argument was, in part, that it might have been prevented. When it comes to the potential that there could be unforeseen issues that arise, perhaps more than just a national security concern, they could be even more broadly a concern to the public and not just the United States. Is it concerning that when it comes to a topic like the UAP that could represent one of those scenarios, that the intelligence agencies don't seem to be sharing information? Yet again, to Moynihan's point, that when this information is kept in a vacuum and kept away from others who might find it useful, sometimes there is a knowledge gap and a blind spot emerges?
Sure. Yeah, sure. And in fact, what you're discussing there is a problem that is systemic and long range. I mean, this has gone on, and you know, secrecy is kind of one of my things, and understanding that system of secrecy, really understanding how it functions. And I think in studying the history of secrecy, which goes back to World War II, the end of World War II, which is interesting, is when it was kind of formalized, what we consider today is the system of secrecy, is that it has evolved over the decades. But what we have continuously found since we had an organized classification system is that it is repeatedly abused, and it is repeatedly, you see exactly what you're describing, is this interagency or interdepartment, intercomponent rivalries, where information is being compartmentalized from other government agencies. You know, I think when they revamped the classification system in the, I believe it was the late 1960s, you know, they you know, during a congressional inquiry, they found that agencies were using upwards of close to 100 unauthorized classifications. You know, they just started classifying their own stuff inside. These are the origins of special access programs, actually. It's kind of interesting. They birthed out of this, that agencies kind of were doing it themselves, hiding, you know, creating their own. You know, this is Mike and Tim classification, and only, you know, if you don't have the code word. They were doing that before SAPs even existed. But they were hiding information both, you know, within their own agencies from people, but like you said, in the furtherance of intelligence sharing, you know, all of the agencies have their own kind of specialties and designation. And each one are supposed to come together to form this really nice, complete picture. That's what makes DNI Haynes' comments even more disturbing, because that, in her position as the director of national intelligence, that was actually created post 9/11 to alleviate this very problem. You know, she's supposed to be the focal point of all of the 19 intelligence agencies that make up the U.S. intelligence community. And so when she's saying the excessive secrecy is a problem, there's a concern there, both in how it's being applied, the cost associated with it. I mean, people don't realize it costs millions upon millions to maintain secrecy. So when you're over-classifying an excessive secrecy, it's a costly endeavor. But then your point is probably the most pressing one in terms of national security, is that over-classification in keeping things compartmented, national security information from other agencies that could come together and stop something like a terrorist attack or solve a problem like UAP, when you're compartmentalizing that's a disturbing trend. And nothing, I mean, though we have seen throughout history that agencies break and violate the security protocol, we also see that it never ends up good. Like, it never helped out to hide that stuff. And unfortunately, when it comes to UAP topics specifically, that is this even multi-layered significant issue, because we've seen this, you know, Christopher Mellon has written about this with us at the debrief about the Air Force kind of taking it upon themselves to and NDAs to their personnel, their airmen, saying, you know, if you have a UAP sighting, you're not to report it to this, this, and this. So they're adding another. You know, that in itself is that compartmentalized secrecy that is preventing data from going to the people trying to investigate it. You know, you're going to have those same types of things very likely across a lot of branches. And, you know, and that's it's unfortunate. But how you stamp that out is a, you know, it's a real question. And I think because secrecy comes from the president, it's one of these things that it actually takes an executive president, takes a sitting president to go, okay, this is what we're doing. We're stopping all that. Because at the end of the day, you know, they have the ability to go, we're declassifying everything. They can do that.
Absolutely. You know, that reminds me too, and you mentioned Chris Mellon's excellent article. I'm going to have that linked in the show notes, as well as your article you did about classification for us there at the Debrief a while back. But I mean, following the second piece that we published this week and the one that I did on Sunday, Chris had actually written to me, and he had mentioned the current UAP class guide, talking about classification, is absurd and legally untenable. He says they now claim that anything and everything UAP is classified. And he actually reached out and wanted to talk a little bit more about this, so we'll probably get some additional information on that out in the days ahead. But, you know, a question I have for you, Tim, is with regard to the current legislation that we saw in the NDAA for fiscal year 2023 and the so-called whistleblower amendment, I have wondered, even with the protections now for people who may have knowledge about special access programs and other things that they've been involved with related to UAP, protections that should allow those individuals to be able to come forward, is it still... Actually, I'll phrase it this way. Is it wrong for me to be concerned that there may still be things that would impede that process, even now that that has gone into law?
No, it's absolutely not wrong for you to be concerned about that. And I think that it's important that people realize that. You know, that's been something that I have, you know, tried to make sure that people are informed about, whether it's on Twitter, which is rarely the best medium to provide information to people to educate anything. But there's been, you know, I've seen angst recently towards the Department of Defense Public Affairs Office as if they're, you know, intentionally covering up UAP, as if the spokesperson themselves for the Department of Defense has that authority, because they don't. You know, they don't have that authority. They're bound by the same classification and are probably compartmented off from different things. And Congress does not have any authority over classification. You know, the Congress cannot declassify anything. And so that's why you'll hear people like Senator Rubio or others come out exasperated going, you know, they should release this and this. The people can handle it. Or, you know, I didn't hear anything, you know, hadn't heard in the public, or, you know, whatever. But they're coming out exasperated saying it needs to be released. But they're not releasing it, because at the end of the day, you know, Congress, you know, our senators do not have authority. That is, you know, our classification. You know, the national security classification comes under the executive order of the President of the United States. Currently, we operate off of an executive order that was issued by President Obama. So all security classification derives its entire authority from the president. And so the president is the only person who has this carte blanche, who can say what is or isn't classified. They can declassify at a whim. In fact, it's come up recently, well, what does that even mean? You know, the president thinks it in their head. I'm going to declassify that. Is it legal? You know, I don't know that that'll go to the Supreme Court. But if you were to take a strict literal approach to certain things, then yes, the president could just think it. And so I think there still are concerns. I think that you know, the will of Congress is being expressed, but the question is, will that translate into A, agencies willing to adhere to that will, or B, how much can they? And because they can't declassify anything carte blanche. And so there is reason to be concerned. I would say, to answer your question rather simply, I think there is still definitely reason to be concerned, because at the end of the day, Congress can jump up and down with their hair on fire saying, you know, all this needs to come out, but they cannot legally remove those classifications.
Yeah, and it's going to be really interesting in the months and years ahead if indeed members of Congress right now who are involved in trying to legislate this, maybe even the director of Aero, Sean Kirkpatrick, and those who are working with him, if they come to find, you know, we were hearing whispers about these kinds of things, programs and all this, and we had this legislation that was supposed to allow these people to come forward, and yet, strangely, somehow, nothing happened. I wonder if that would change people's mindset about the history of secrecy with relation to the UAP topic. We're about out of time here, Tim, but again, what's next for you, and what can folks expect here in the days ahead at our little hub on the web known as The Debrief?
Man, I'm just trying to stay warm here in Germany. We've hit a nice little cold front, but always have something cooking up. You know, we will try to stay on top of them. You know, that's the other thing is that we you know, Congress has a little more power than us, but at the same time, we can't force the Department of Defense or the president to give us anything, but we will stay on top of this with the videos and stuff, try to continue to hammer away at information when it pertains to UAP and just breakthrough technology. We've got some fun stuff coming up. In fact, I'll have some stuff I'm working on this week that might pertain to the transmedium question, but not necessarily the transmedium question that everybody's hoping, at least the UAP transmedium question.
Well, you know, if you're talking about earthly technology that moves us toward a better understanding of other potentials, hey, that's really in our wheelhouse. And of course, at home, everybody make sure you follow Tim's work there at thedebrief.org, where you can find his articles, my articles, and contributions by the entire team, MJ Benias, Chris Plain, and Chrissy Newton. Tim, it's always a pleasure to get on the mic with you, too.
Always fun, Mike, man. Always a pleasure.
And again, I'd tell Mr. McMillan to let everybody know where they can find him online. But folks at home, of course, you already know. You can follow his work. You can follow mine, Chris Plain, MJ Benias, Chrissy Newton, all of us over there at thedebrief.org. Independent news. And providing you the latest intelligence in the civilian sector on all these issues related to UAP, defense, science, artificial intelligence, and so much more. And of course, you can also keep up with me over at MicahHanks.com. In the days ahead, we will have some additional commentary, as always, for Axe subscribers. In the meantime, you can reach me at info@MicahHanks.com and on Twitter @MicahHanks. It's always a pleasure to be here with you guys. Thanks again to Tim McMillan for joining me. I'll catch you next time. And as always, you guys, stay strange out there.